It's been a couple days since we published our COVID-19 UK edition. It is time for the US edition. When it comes to finances, it is a little bit of a mixed bag. We have reporting from conferences who have dropped in tithe 33%, 44%. Some conferences dropped only 1%. Some conferences actually went up in tithe as of the month of March. April is still yet to be determined. Some conferences did apply to the Payment Protection Program, a relief program from the government. Two conferences, one in the Columbia Union and one in the Southwestern Union, were approved and accepted, but we do not know whether the money has been disbursed. We have been told that the executive committee has to approve that, and as of May 3rd, they are still working through that. So we may give you a general update in one of our ads in the future. Thank you for tuning in to Disruptive Adventism. Today, we're talking with Nicholas Miller, a lawyer and professor of church history. He's going to provide us with perspective into the past, how Adventists handled the previous pandemic in 1918, and how do we understand COVID-19 with religious liberty in our church today. But first, we get a little bit more background to the specific situation that Dr. Miller is in, which is the state of Michigan, a state that has remained closed, and that is one of the key states for the election. This state still has shelter-in-place orders, and we're still going through what's going to happen. Let's hear from Dr. Miller. This was shot a couple weeks ago. Here he is.
Well, I think it's been much like the rest of the United States, if not the world. We've been basically on a lockdown with only essential trips allowed outside the home. It's not perhaps as severe as it sounds. You don't really have to stay in your house 24 hours a day. The order allows for recreational trips outside. As long as you keep social distancing going, you can go biking or hiking or running. Any outdoor activity that you can keep, 6 to 10 feet away from others. A friend of mine next door and I go for daily disc golf walks through the parks and the lands of Andrews University here. There is a bit of controversy here in Michigan, actually, because just last week the governor extended the lockdown until at least the end of April, and she also added some provisions. Many of the businesses were closed; essential ones stay open. But places like Walmart and Lowe's, big box stores, have essential parts to them. But then people were going and buying things in what were considered unessential sections. So she put a provision in, sort of locking down the home and garden areas and, paint supplies. And a lot of people think that this has been unnecessary and she's going too far. And in fact, there was a rather lively protest in Lansing, the capital of Michigan, yesterday, where some conservative groups got thousands of people together to go driving through the capital, honking their horns. And so the governor's a Democrat, a left-wing politician, and Michigan has a fair number of strong conservatives here. And so there's a brewing confrontation between those who think that she's overstepped her bounds and made the lockdown too restrictive.
So on a personal level, people can go out, buy essential items, they can exercise, but how is the church being affected in this key state? Are the guidelines infringing upon some of the rights from the Constitution, like religious liberty? And more importantly, how is the precedent of the Spanish flu giving us perspective into what's happening today and what's going to happen in the future? Here's Dr. Miller.
Well, this is a very interesting point, and I don't know why that this has happened, given that the governor is Democrat and liberal. She actually has placed in her orders the clause that these laws will not be enforced as to groups meeting for worship services. So technically in Michigan, there is a fairly generous exemption for meeting for worship purposes, unlike some other states that have restricted also worship services. Now, the irony perhaps is that most church organizations here in Michigan, certainly the Seventh-day Adventist Church, have chosen to voluntarily follow the guidelines and the federal guidelines and also the state laws. And all of our churches are not meeting in person. We're live streaming services. So whatever the protests are, they don't have to do with religion, because the governor specifically exempted religion, though in many states that's not the case. And there are Christian groups. In fact, in California, just in the last couple of days, several churches sued the governor there, Governor Newsom, because of his restriction on church services and meetings. And so these issues of quarantine and public health versus religious liberty and the right to assemble are going to clash in court. You know, there's always a few voices on Facebook that suggest we're capitulating too easily to the government's limitations. But I think we just genuinely recognize it as a health crisis, and that we're staying home for the benefit of our older members. So we have many people that could be jeopardized by these if we chose to gather. And, you know, taking a page from history, being a historian, you're familiar with the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. And of course, our church existed at that time. So I was very interested to see if there had been similar kinds of shutdowns then. And if so, how had our church reacted to that? Because we've always had this very sensitive outlook to religious liberty issues. Right. And certainly our pioneers and early church leaders spoke much about, you know, the dangers of the government intruding into church worship. And so I went back and read some of the Adventist reviews, as well as the Lake Union Heralds from 1918 and 1919. And I discovered that indeed there had been shutdowns. There were periods of time for 2 months where schools did not meet, churches did not meet, evangelistic campaigns didn't happen, camp meetings didn't happen, just complete shutdown. And remember, this was at a time when there wasn't the internet and live streaming and Zoom Sabbath school and all of that that we can continue with today. All I could find was matter-of-fact reporting that these things happened, that Adventists did not meet, that they focused on medical missionary work from their homes. And I hope we can talk a little bit about our natural remedies and the hydrotherapy they did, which was actually very effective. But nary a peep could I find about religious liberty issues or the Constitution or the deprivation of civil liberties. I think that Adventists, we were on the cutting edge of health issues and health reform. And it seems that most people accepted this as a genuine need for public health, both of the church and of the community. And really, it seems that today we're more vocal about these things because we've lost a sense, I think, of the balance between health and other rights, and that religious freedom isn't an absolute right, right? It's something that's weighed and balanced in with the other rights that people have.
Interesting. Adventists in the past were focused on a specific message. They saw the opportunity to make an impact when it comes to health. But now we are in another pandemic and it's passing by. Some states are reopening. Did we take advantage, or were we just plain fear-mongering at this time? We're taking a break. More to come. We'll be right back with more Disruptive Adventism. Thanks for listening. Welcome back to Disruptive Adventism. So far, we've learned that Adventists recognized the pandemic, the 1918 pandemic, as an opportunity to help others, to be the hands and feet of Jesus, and to deliver a message of health. Today, however, many are concerned with something else, not health, but religious freedom, as other Christians are. So why the difference? What has changed after 100 years? Why did we move from a message of hope and helping to a message of crying wolf?
Well, I think after Ellen White died in the 1920s and 1930s, Adventism very much had an encounter and was influenced by what I call fundamentalism, by a very conservative branch of evangelical Christianity that had a more absolutist approach to, well, a number of things, but certainly including church and state. They had an absolutist approach to the separation of church and state in ways that Our pioneers didn't. Our pioneers were involved in public policy matters, opposing slavery, seeking laws to outlaw the sale and use of alcohol. Even though we believe that the church and state spiritually should be kept separate, we thought that church members should have a moral engagement with their society. But fundamentalists tended to want to completely separate it. The church should be quietist, pietist. And part of this was also then a belief in the kind of absolutist view of religious freedom, that my right to religious freedom is absolute and shouldn't be weighed or balanced in any way by the government with other concerns in society. And while it's tempting for us as Christian believers to view our religious rights as absolute, the problem is if you, a quick thought test the limits of that is, well, what if there was a sect or a cult that believed in human sacrifice, right? Would we allow that? Would we accept that? Well, no, that would be going too far. So what if it was a cult or a sect that believed not in human sacrifice, but in, passing around a disease that could be quite deadly under some circumstances and threaten the community? Shouldn't there be limits on that? And the answer, if you think about it, would appear to be yes. So Adventists have always accepted that there needs to be that my right to practice my religion, like all other rights, trails off and diminishes as I begin impacting and affecting other people in the community. And that's what's at stake here.
So what about Revelation 13? What about prophecy? Is this not playing out like we have been teaching? Maybe we're wrong? Dr. Miller with the answer.
So it's very hard for Adventists, right? Because our eschatology is about the government intervening in our worship and preventing us from going to church. And lo and behold, what's happening? You know, in many places, the government is doing exactly that. The trouble is there's two special parts of Revelation 13 that just aren't being fulfilled in this current event. And one of them is, it's not just about not being able to go to church, it's that certain minority religious groups are discriminated against and aren't able to worship as they are convicted, right? It's that there's a majority religious view and then these minorities that are being prevented. And that's just not the case here. It's all gatherings, not even just all religious gatherings. It's concerts, it's sporting events, it's everything. So there's not a discrimination against religion. And the second point about Revelation 13 is that there's a coercion of worship, right? It's talking about you must worship or you'll receive this mark of the beast. And at this point, nobody is engaged in coercive worship or saying you must worship in a certain kind of way. So I have a student, I think you remember who David Hamstra was and is, still is. He is a PhD student at the seminary. I'm working with him on his projects. He's now back. He finished his classwork and he's a pastor in Canada now. But I want to give him credit whenever I use this phrase because he helped me put together a little, it's kind of like a scriptural acronym. He came up with the couplet that what's happening now isn't Revelation 13, it's Leviticus 13. And Leviticus 13 has to do with the quarantine laws of Israel. And then I added to that, so let's act like 1 Corinthians 13, of course, which is the great chapter on love and the way we should treat our neighbors and each other, until Romans 13 is complete. And Romans 13 is the passage in the New Testament that talks about the legitimate role of government punishing evil and in rewarding good. And so these four texts, all with a chapter 13, remind us that Revelation 13 is not necessarily filled by doing what's in Leviticus 13. The Bible itself recognizes the legitimacy of a quarantine period, even for people who aren't known to be fully sick. If you read Leviticus 13, it's people who are suspected, and they're quarantined for 7 days, which would prevent them from going to church. And this system is actually endorsed by Christ, wasn't it? Because when he heals the lepers, what does he do? He sends them to be declared clean by the priest. So the quarantine system was still in place. And as Christians, too many people are talking about my rights to worship. Whereas if we really thought about 1 Corinthians 13, we might think about other people's rights to be free from death and dying from the disease that our worship could bring to them. So why don't we just take a breather and think about Romans 13 and the role that government legitimately does play. And insofar as there really is a threat to health and life, it seems to me that these quarantine restrictions, as long as they're passed neutrally and they apply to everyone, they're not focused on one particular religious group, really that doesn't rise to the level of the Revelation 13 that we've talked about. But all of this doesn't mean that we shouldn't be cautious and careful and on the lookout for the usurpation of power and authority, which always happens at times of crisis, right? We're as citizens, we're going to have to be on our guard, because you give the government an inch and they'll take a mile. And so, yes, we need to be careful. But if we start yelling too quickly and too soon and we cry wolf when there really is a legitimate concern, then we're going to undermine our ability to speak frankly and candidly about this in the future.
We take another break. Thanks for listening to Disruptive Adventism. Before we continue with the final segment of Disruptive Adventism, I want to thank you, Thomas Rasmussen. He was able to tape sync this interview and get us some of this amazing content that you're listening to. Thanks again, Thomas. And please check out his YouTube channel. It'll be linked below. He has other conversations about coronavirus, health, faith, and much, much more content for your enjoyment. Thanks again, Thomas. So as we have learning, a lot of Adventists during the Spanish flu, they delivered a message of hope and helping during this time. Dr. Miller expounds on another topic during that time, a seminary who was actually doing something that mitigated the virus, and how we can learn for future pandemics, and maybe how can we help the community, especially our medical professionals, in this battle against this sickness.
Well, we've always taught that the health work is the right arm of the message, and that it plays a powerful and important role in reaching our communities. And most members have tended to view that as a special part of the work that our nurses and doctors are carrying out. We have various hospital systems and clinics. But there was a very interesting editorial in the 1918 Adventist Review in October. And we were told by the medical director of the General Conference at the time, Dr. Rubel, that our church members should become medical missionaries, all, not just our nurses and doctors, but that there should be health programs at our churches to teach people how to give simple in-home remedies for dealing with these problems. And this just wasn't talk. There was actually some rather remarkable outcomes to the Spanish flu. It was quite a lethal flu, certainly as lethal, if not more, than the one in the present pandemic. There was a second wave of it that was particularly fatal that peaked in about October 1918. And death rates were as high as 10 to 15% in various parts of the country and the world. There was a seminary, and actually Scandinavian seminary, that I was not aware of in Charleston, Minnesota. But there were 180 students at it, and there were 120 that lived on the campus, and 90 of them came down with symptoms of influenza. There was a physician on staff who knew about Adventist natural remedies, hydrotherapy, and they followed a course of action with each of the students as they came down with the illness, and they were tended by nurses and some of the other students. They would isolate them, put them to bed, give them a balanced, healthy diet to boost their immune system. And then they carried out hydrotherapy, which consisted of poultices, fomentations, hot towels put on the chest and throat and also on the back for about 15 or 20 minutes at a time, and then a cold covering afterwards. And they repeat this 3 or 4 times a day. And they did that with all the patients as soon as the first symptoms were noticed. And they had no fatalities out of the 90 students. And in fact, none of the students progressed to the pneumonia stage of the disease. And the public health official of Charleston at the time commented that the handling of this at the Charleston Seminary, it had the best record of any institution in the state of Minnesota in dealing with this. Since I first researched this story, I discovered that similar testimonies exist for Southern Adventist University and Oakwood and some other places as well, where these treatments were. It's not that once the disease progressed to the level of pneumonia, these weren't fail-proof methods for bringing people back, right? These were things you could do at the more mild to moderate levels of the progression. And so I don't want to communicate that everybody at every stage of this hydrotherapy is the end all and be all. It's something that took place at the earlier stages and prevented the progression. And if people have progressed pneumonia, this is not meant to be a substitute for conventional medical care. It's meant to be a supplement and an earlier intervention to prevent the progression. If you had the progression, then you need to go in and see a doctor and maybe be in an ICU.
So we can learn from the past. As Adventists, we were being the hands and feet of Jesus. We were helping others understand how health works, and we were delivering a message of hope and helping of the community. We can do that today, and we hope to do that today. Here is Dr. Miller's final word. Thanks for listening to Disrupted Adventism. Make sure to share the episode, and we'll see you on the next one.
I think that you bring hope to yourself as you seek to bring help and hope to others. And I think in many places, we're rediscovering the communities that we live in. I recently moved into a new neighborhood and don't know terribly well the people around me, but I've made a point. I have senior citizens living on either side of me. And so it's given me an opportunity every few days. I go in and check and see if everyone's okay and offer to do a grocery run we're encouraging our seniors to stay inside, and it's given me an opportunity to pray with them. That's just my situation. I know that everybody has somebody near them that they can provide some support and help and comfort to, whether it be over the phone or over Skype. The ministry of Jesus was to meet the needs of the people as he saw them and those immediately around them. And certainly this has given us that opportunity. And I pray that we as Adventists will take every advantage of it, to be positive, to share things on the internet that are hopeful and uplifting. Obviously, sometimes you have to share news that's not. I'm just looking at a story that I shared about a Virginia pastor who decided that he was protected by God and he was going to defy the authorities, and he called a church service. And they had a meeting, and unfortunately, just a few days ago, he died from the coronavirus, and now his family is infected as well. I'm comforted to know that God sometimes accepts our overzealous service, he will be judged by a gracious and kind and merciful Heavenly Father. But it's also an illustration to us of the line between faith and presumption. And when God gives us science and the ability to understand these maladies, that we need to act in a way to help us and to help our neighbors in a spirit of love. And let's be known for that, and not as the people who oppose the authorities and at the risk of their own lives and that of our neighbors. Let's stand for conscience when that's important, but let's not be presumptuous in doing so.
You've been listening to Disruptive Adventism. We hope that today's topic help you to think and change something about your practices, about your faith, about your Adventism. If you want to subscribe, make sure to go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcast. We'll be there. And make sure to give us a review if you like what you're listening to. If you want to support, make sure to go to patreon.com/disruptiveadventism. It helps us pay our bills and produce the content that you're listening to. And if you want to socialize, make sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram or on Twitter, and hit us up whenever you need anything. We'll be there to support you. Thank you for listening today. We hope you join us next time. And as always, we invite you to be disruptive.